The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, this is Martin Fowler, and you're listening to The Agile Uprising.
And welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm Colleen Johnson, and my co-hosts today are Troy. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, hey.
And we're joined today with our amazing guest, Melissa Perry. Hello, Melissa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. I am super excited to talk with you today. You've actually been on the podcast with us before with Matt Barcombe talking about flow-based roadmaps. And today we're going to talk about your new book, Escaping the Build Trap, how effective product management creates real value. So for those of you who haven't picked up the book yet, I can't recommend this book enough. I feel like there's always kind of a handful of books that as consultants we keep referring to people that we interact with and coach. And as soon as I finished this, I emailed probably three or four different people to say, please go get this book right away. You have to read this. It's so important. So first of all, yeah, excellent job on this. First things first, we're on an Agile podcast here, and you're likely speaking to an audience of a lot of Agile practitioners, so I want to go ahead and get this out of the way first. A product manager is not the same as a product owner, so I'm going to hand that over to you, Melissa. Will you speak to that?
Yeah, so there is a lot of confusion, I think, around titles in the Agile world, because Agile's got this title called product owner, but if you look at the companies that grew up in Silicon Valley, we were all called product managers, so everybody's going, what's the difference between a product owner and a product manager? And I think one of the key differences is when you learn product ownership in Agile, right, you're not really learning the whole domain of product management and what it takes to be a product manager. Usually, if you go to a CSBO class or if you go to learn about how to do things, it talks a lot about process. So grooming the backlog, you know, working with developers to prioritize, making sure that they have enough information, setting the vision. And it doesn't really tell you how to do those things in a lot of Agile literature. And that's why we say product ownership is a difference between, it's just a piece of product management. And it's a piece of what a product manager does. But if you take Scrum away, right, if you take Agile processes away, and let's say you go back to, God forbid, Waterfall, but that's where a lot of this came from, right? If you go back to that, you still need product management. You still need to be a product manager. So product ownership is just a piece. It's just more about the how do you work with the Scrum teams. It's just a piece of the puzzle. Whereas product management, right, being a product manager is about connecting strategy back into the business, back into those processy pieces to really evolve and lead a product into from conception all the way into implementation and make sure that it achieves goals. So that's why I like to call people really product managers instead of product owners. I try not to have product owners and product managers on the teams that we restructure or we work with. But everybody's a product manager, and there's just different levels of product management from, you know, all the way down to an associate product manager, all the way up to a chief product officer. And that's why the role is just so much bigger than, you know, grooming a backlog or working with developers. It's a lot. It's a very strategic role. It's very much bridging the gap between tech and business and user experience so that you can create a product that's going to produce value.
So I've heard you talk about this on other forums, but I'm not going to put words in your mouth and say that you said this, but what I feel like you're describing is a dumbing down of a product role by just sticking to just product owners. Is that, yes. Do you feel like that's the main reason why we're struggling in the product world of Agile teams?
Yeah, I do. And I think that's probably a good way to, I don't think I've used that term before, but now I'm going to steal it from you. But it does feel like that. Like the product owner, the way that it's implemented in a lot of companies, it's almost like this secretarial position, right? Where there's not a lot of really authority applied with the product owners that I've seen. There's a lot of, let's start from the beginning. So I've been involved in a lot of agile transformations. I've come into companies that had 350 new scrum teams, 350 new product owners, right? Overseeing those scrum teams who've never done it before. I did a very large transformation at a healthcare company for 2 years. I've worked with very large financial institutions to do these different transformations as well. And it's the same story everywhere I've seen of somebody who's gone through an agile transformation. We've taken people from other parts of the business, we make them product owners, and then we just tell them to go. And we assume that those people can really fulfill this job because we look at the role and we go, oh, well, they just kind of have to prioritize this backlog and then make sure the developers are working on the most important things. And in theory, that sounds pretty simple because it's just a piece of the puzzle, right? So that by thinking that a product owner just does that, right, we are dumbing down the position. And I'm not saying that everybody thinks a product owner does that. And I don't think Agile intended, if you talk to people who really created Agile or looked at those product owner positions, I don't believe that's what they intended for this role to be just that. I think they believed it to be a role that a product manager or somebody in the business would really play that does all those strategy pieces, and that was implied. But it's taken on a life of its own now where people think product owners have this tiny little subset of a job where they run the team and they decide what people should be working on and they make sure things are prioritized and it's working that way. And when I come into
order
those
takers.
Order takers, right? They're waiters, I call them in the book, right? Where you come over and the stakeholders say like, hey, I need this, or a customer says like, build me this feature. They write it down, they've turned it into a user story and they put it in a backlog. And that's how a lot of people operate when they haven't really had that domain of growing up in a role that was product management, that was a product manager, right? They tend to resort back to those order taker ways and see themselves almost just as a filter back into the development team, rather than like a strategic position of trying to figure out how do we further our business and how do we produce more value for our customers by figuring out what is the right thing to build. And that's really what the core of product management is.
Yeah, and I think we can probably all relate to seeing organizations that have created auxiliary roles to the product owner to fill that gap, mm-hmm. like a product strategy role or some of the things that you talk about that are part of that all-encompassing responsibility for a product management, you know, mm-hmm. for a product manager to take. And like you said, the waiter type, you break down some of the common archetypes that we see from a product management type perspective in the book. And I thought in some ways it was kind of painful to read through all of those because they're so familiar, but you highlight a lot of the things that you need in a great product manager. And you call out being humble, empathy for the customer, ability to influence, bringing the team together towards a common goal. So would you say that there's a specific type of person that will flourish more or thrive more as a product manager, or can all those things be learned by the folks that are in maybe shoved into a product owner role?
Yeah, I do think there's inherently some people who thrive better in a product management role than others. When we go into organizations, we do a lot of assessments of product managers to kind of figure out what level they're at and whether they're really going to thrive in that role. Well, I think you can learn any of the skills that are needed for product management, right? Like road mapping, prioritization skills, how to talk to users, right? Like all of those are very learnable skills. I do think there is a certain amount of personality traits and comfort with things like risk or ambiguity or standing up to leadership or really like leading a team, right? Making decisions that you can learn, but some people are not going to be comfortable with those things like other people are. And that's really where I see the difference between like, are people really going to be suited for this role and not? So when I go in and I start talking to people, a lot of what I'll tell people who are trying to get into product too, I don't know if you're going to like this role, because are you comfortable going to a CEO and telling him, no, I'm not going to build that, right? And having a justified reason, right? Saying like, I pulled the data, I've looked this, it's not going to further the business. Like, you have to be able to stand up to the people above you and around you who you consider stakeholders and push back for the greater good of the product, right? And for the greater good of the team. And that's not a skill I see in a ton of people. There's definitely a lot of people who have it. There's a lot of people who want to learn it. But that's a big skill. Being able to make a quick decision without a lot of, information. Like, we want to go out and we want to test our hypotheses. We want to gather information. But then there becomes a crux where we've got as much as we possibly can. And in order to move things forward, you know, we have to put a stake in the sand and just say like, okay, go this way, right? And let's test it and make sure that we're doing it. So it's a bias to action, to test things, to get those MVPs out the door quicker, to not, I'm not saying that they shouldn't base everything in data, right? But we can't spend, you know, 24 months gathering data sometimes to make those decisions. So you have to be comfortable assessing what you're having and taking the best path forward and then looking back and saying, okay, let's learn and iterate on it. And I've seen people struggle with that too. So, and influence skills. Influence skills are one of the biggest ones. One of our directors of product here, Marissa, she's writing a blog post on it right now because it's such a critical skill. There's a lot that goes into this kind of presence and empathy for people that you're working with to be able to assess and figure out how do I go to our head of sales, right? And convince them that they should not promise this to the customer because it's not the best for the product. Like, how do I work with those people and really come to the best conclusion for it, right? So you have to be able to influence, you have to be able to gain the respect of your peers so that they listen to you and they want to work with you. And those are very critical skills, I think, for product managers as well.
It's almost a little bit of politicking, right? It's less directing. Yep.
Yeah. And I actually met somebody last night. I'm in a bowling league now. That's pretty interesting in Brooklyn. And he's a new product manager. He's been one for 6 months. And I asked him, like, how do you like it? And he said, you know, I love everything about it except the politics. And I'm like, that's going to be your next, it's going to be most of your life for a lot going forward. And there is a lot of politics to play in being product manager, which I don't think everybody really expects when they get into it. I think people look at it and say, hey, oh, you got to be the person who comes up with the ideas and you're the inherent leader, right? But people just don't give you those leadership rights off the bat, and they shouldn't. You have to stand up for it, right? Like, and you have to know how to influence people. You have to show that you are a leader, right? Nobody's going to just hand that to you. And that's a really big part of being a product manager.
The book also talks about how many organizations get stuck in this product death trap, right? So I think we see some of this from a Scrum perspective or an Agile perspective, and just trying to focus on how quickly we can deliver. And you really focus in on how we can get stuck just producing features without validating them, right? And why do you think it's so hard for organizations to start investing in that upfront step of validating ideas?
Yeah, I think it's hard because we tend to look at momentum in organizations as how much do we ship, right? And it's I think it really goes back into what are we measuring as success? And there's easy things to measure and then there's harder things to measure. And easy things to measure are like, how many features did I ship last month? How many story points did we complete, right? And we look at these metrics that are really tangible. They're things that we can grab onto. They're easily measured. Everybody knows where they live, right? And we start judging success solely by those. But we forget to go measure the things that are really hard, which are what value are we producing? And a lot of the value metrics as well are lagging indicators, not leading indicators. So they take time to measure. So if you put a feature out there tomorrow, right, you may not get signals back or that it's reached its goals or it's produced the revenue for like another couple months, right? You can start seeing if sales trends will go up, but you're not really sure if it's actually super, super tangible being valuable, right? Like you have to put it out there and start measuring it back. And you have some leading indicators that will show it will, but you have to measure the end result too. And I think that's why we really get stuck in the build trap, because we're looking for easy things to measure. We put our heads down. We forget to take a step back and stop and reflect on what we're doing and saying, hey, like, is the work that we're doing really going to produce value? Is it going to be something that our customers want? Is it helping to increase revenue for our companies? Is it really making our users happy? How are we doing with competition? Are we lagging behind? Are we setting ourselves up to succeed in the future? Right? A lot of times we get so caught up with the operational pieces of the work of building and designing and doing all of this work that we don't stop, right? We never take a step back, even with strategic planning, right? To look at what is this going to do? A lot of the strategic planning sessions that I've observed in these companies are just lists of stuff we want to commit to next year. They're not actually tied back to a big push from a strategy and they're not tied back to the why, right? And every company needs to have some kind of why. It has to be, you know, we work with a ton of growth stage companies right now with Insight Venture Partners, which is our VC partner, and we're helping their companies grow. And all of their whys tend to go to, you know, we're trying to do explosive growth over the next couple of years, but there's different strategies for how to get there. And you want to make sure that everything you're building, everything the teams are working on, are aligned to the appropriate strategy. And that you know that if I've got five Scrum teams working on, you know, an initiative, it's the right initiative that ties back up to those company goals. And that takes work to prepare, and it takes, you know, it takes a lot of, it doesn't take a lot of time, but like it takes infrastructure to put together to make sure that we can measure those things. And I think we just get so bogged down with this obsession around shipping and getting things out the door that we forget to sometimes take the time to implement the things that will show us, or the tools that will show us, that we are all aligned and we're all going towards the right why.
So does this company hierarchy or organizational hierarchy get in the way of that? And I say that you've probably spent, I know you spent a lot of time in the startup world, but as the companies and products get bigger and bigger and bigger, it seems to me like, how do we validate something when we have to go five levels above for any sort of strategic thinking?
Well, I mean, I've spent most of my time in the enterprise world, actually, with 45,000 people companies and 5,000 people companies. And the companies we help, we have one team that is working with the growth stage companies at this Insight portfolio that range from 250 people in companies, but we also work with companies that have 5,000 people. Like they're all different all over the place. It's just about, is the revenue growing fast? So it's the same everywhere, right? I've seen enterprises that have way too many layers and way too many processes that are standing in the way for people making strategic decisions. I see enterprises that don't actually have product people or are not set up correctly at the top to help make sure that the right strategies are being deployed down. So a really common example for people who've, for companies, right, for financial, I see this a lot in financial companies as well. Like if you haven't traditionally grown up as a software company, you don't, product becomes an afterthought in a lot of these older companies. Product is the thing that you do during an agile transformation. And you're like, oh yeah, wait, now I got all these product owners, what should I do? And a lot of companies think that to stand up a product org, you're basically just putting product owners around every Scrum team. And they don't realize that there is several layers to product management. There are, you need a VP of product to be able to oversee the entire value stream and make sure that all of the features are working in concert with that product, or to, you know, automate those processes. You need somebody to oversee that stuff, and they have to be on an executive level with that division of that corporation. You need a chief product officer to make sure that across the organization, you're not doing redundant work. You're scaling systems, you're scaling products that help deliver value back to your customers, right? And that may operationalize in different parts of the business or different business lines, which is totally fine. But it's not just about putting a lot of people on the ground floor to go talk to customers. It's about holistically optimizing and growing your company through product to scale rather than services or people, right? Like that's kind of where the product mindset comes from. It's about, how do I use software to grow this company and optimize it and scale it in a way where I don't have to hire 14,000 people to do the same type of work, right? Or how do I deliver value faster to my customers through software, right? That's really where the product mindset comes from. And a lot of organizations, the way that they are set up or the way that they are organized, do not optimize for that. They optimize instead for policies or for building up different business lines or different pieces of the organization, and they don't do the work across the organization to really look at those two things. How do I scale and make sure my systems are optimized for that? And then how do I actually deliver value to my customers through software better?
Hello, Melissa. Yes. It's Troy, chiming in here. I just want to say that I just ordered your book, so I should get it in a couple of days, I guess, from Amazon. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited for that. I did have a question for you regarding measurements. So I'm an agile coach and a consultant, and recently I've been working a lot at the portfolio level and with product management. So that's why this is very intriguing to me, your work and your book. So one of the things that that I coach is to move away from project, move towards a hypothesis-driven development at a portfolio level. Mm-hmm. So, for example, at a recent client, we've had some really good success kicking that off. It's going pretty well, but I always come back to, you know, how do we know what to measure? And really, how do we learn from mistakes from the past when it comes to mistakes in scientific hypothesis? For example, for those who aren't familiar, there's something called Goddard's Law. And there's a brilliant woman named Marilyn Strathern, and she has this quote, and it says, when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to become a good measure. It ceases to be a good measure. So if we think about that when we are creating our hypothesis-driven initiatives, whether large initiatives or smaller, we're trying to think of leading and lagging indicators to know if we're on the right path. Mm-hmm. But there is this human bias towards wanting to prove yourself right. And mm-hmm. particularly, how do we stay away from that, or how do we protect against that bias and actually think about, if we have an idea or a hypothesis, how do we try to prove ourselves wrong? And then if we can't prove ourselves wrong, then we know we're on the right path. So it's kind of a different approach. So I was just curious as to your experience with that and maybe some successes or failures when it comes to measurements and hypothesis-driven development.
Yeah, I think figuring out what to measure and what's going to be the success metric is definitely one of the trickiest parts when it comes to hypothesis-driven development. And it's especially hard if you're not collecting data. And I've seen a lot of companies that actually are not collecting product engagement metrics or the things that are going to tell us what's right from wrong. So like, that's a hard one to start out with. But let's say you are collecting those things. And you're trying to avoid the bias that you're talking about. I've seen it where I've had it where people have set the metrics of their experiments to basically never fail. And I think part of it is being like honest with yourself as a product manager or as a team, right? And really looking at, hey, we want more things to fail than we want to succeed, right? The places where I see people struggle with setting the right metrics is when they are like, hey, I want to make sure that my idea actually goes through, and we're going to create an experiment to prove it right so that it does go through. Whereas good product managers, in my opinion, really take a different approach and say, I only want to push this through if it's the best idea. If I cannot build this, I will save us so much time and money. And that's kind of the approach that I've always taken with product management. So we want to try to prove ourselves wrong because it saves the company money if we're not going in the right way. And it helps us actually focus more on the right things to do. So from like a tactical perspective, how do we make sure that we're not biased? I think it's really looking at what are the reasons for us doing these things too. And I would say like, if you're really attached to your idea, maybe pull in like some fellow product managers or developers or people who don't really love your idea to give you better feedback on those metrics and on those decision-making points so that they can keep you honest, right, around those things. But I think it's more about like changing your perspective of like, why are you building the things you're building? And I like to call product managers bad idea terminators, right? And I mm-hmm. tell them to see their role as that, right? Like your job is not necessarily to build all the, it's not to build all the ideas, right? Like your job is to really focus everybody on building the right ideas. So you want to kill all the bad ideas as fast as possible. The more bad ideas you kill, the more room you leave to work on the right ones. So to me, that's how I really encourage people to look at hypothesis-driven development. It's not really about proving if we're right. It's more about, let's prove if we're wrong. Great. We don't have to do that. Moving on.
Right. No, it makes a lot of sense. Thanks, Melissa. And so in practice, so it's kind of like in the development world, we have our code reviews, right? So, or even pair programming, right? Or even mob programming. So maybe taking those practices on the development team and just applying them to product management as a good practice and a good ritual, or so to speak, to always practice.
Yeah, one of the first bosses that I had as a product manager or VP of product, like way back when, he used to have product group meetings. There was five of us product managers on the team. I was working at an e-commerce startup at the time, and he would bring us together every week, and we would reflect on what we're doing, and we'd give each other feedback, and we'd challenge our opinions. Like, why are you doing that? And at that place is really where I got into hypothesis-driven development as well. So when we started actually putting goals around things, right, we would challenge our goals. We'd come together and be like, I think we can make that number like a little bit lower. Like you're being, you know, like maybe that success metric is too generous. Like maybe you have to make it a little more stringent. Like how much money are we actually going to spend projected on their work? Like let's calculate it. And I think having that practice, like that community of practice around product management, which we've extended into enterprise companies that I've worked with as well. It's great. Like it just gives you feedback in, you know, you're working with like, you know, good partners on stuff, and it keeps you really honest and make sure that you're on the right track.
Awesome. Thanks, Melissa.
So Melissa, I'll move on to the next question. So I have a feeling where you're going to go with this, but I know that there's a lot of critique around agile frameworks and what they do to product innovation and how it can sometimes be seen as a struggle. Like where do you stand with your work in terms of any, and I don't want to pick on any particular one. They all have their pluses and they all have their minuses, right? But just in terms of when you come and work with a group, regardless of their framework, like how do you approach that in a way that encourages innovation?
Yeah. I've worked at places that have used all different types of frameworks at this point. I've worked with places that are still doing a waterfall. And in the right context, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. Most places use Scrum. I've worked with places that use SAFe. And to me, it's not necessarily the things that prevent innovation, right, are when you're so rigid to a process that you don't give yourselves room for improvement. And that's the part that frustrates me a lot with different types of frameworks. It's less about the framework itself, and it's more about, I see people say like, this isn't working, this isn't working, this isn't working, but hey, we can't change it because this is a framework we use. I've seen companies now come through that after using particular frameworks and say, we realized that didn't work, but it took us 5 years and now we're changing things. But that to me is what really stifles innovation. I think the thing to remember about agile frameworks, and almost I'd say like it's every agile framework I've ever seen, it's not a strategic framework. And you need not just an agile framework in order to make your company work. You need a strategy deployment process. You need strategy creation process. You need to, like, agile frameworks are really good about like bringing people together to have those conversations. I think there's a lot of value in the way that they set up teams. I think there's a lot of value in the way that they encourage people to work together. Cross-functional stuff, love it, all those types of things. But what I see a lot leave out is the pieces about like, how do we make sure that we're organizing and aligning around what you said, like a portfolio approach to really harness innovation and to make sure that people are moving in the right directions, they're going after the right things, they're learning from the customers, and they're really producing things of value and measuring it that way. And I think where the frameworks get in the way is just when people look at it, they've tried the framework, it's not working in their context, but they're afraid to change something or try something new because they're like, no, this is a framework we use, we can't possibly do that.
Well, or they're just new at the framework. I mean, we've all coached these frameworks before, and when they're first starting, they don't really know how to improvise and iterate on the framework because they're just kind of starting out. And so that I love what you said about adherence to rigidity and needing to do things by the book. I couldn't agree with you more. I'm going to turn around and steal that since you stole what I said earlier. That I just think that we don't think for, it's like we think that if you just follow the book, everything will be fine. And in reality, that rarely ever happens, right?
Yeah, that's it. And that's to me like the biggest downfalls of frameworks, right? Like frameworks I don't think are inherently bad by any means. It's all about context. Like how do you apply them in your context? How do you make them work for you? And when people are unwilling to, what one of the agile principles are, right? Like inspect and adapt. When they're unwilling to do that at a macro level and a framework level, right? That's where they get into trouble. And to me, that's been some of the biggest downfalls from agile transformations I've seen. Is just their unwillingness to do that and think that, no, I'll just keep my heads down. We'll just keep going this way. As long as we go this way, it'll work eventually. And I do think there's an adjustment period. I do think you know, when you first start using something, you have to give it a shot and you have to get good at it. But then there is a time where you have to take a step back and reflect on it and say, is this working for us? And if not, what can we do to change it?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the other things you guys are kind of touching on here with the strategy piece that I've run into in some of the consulting work that I've been doing is organizations will have something like OKRs in place mm-hmm. for their strategy side, and they'll be using maybe Safe or Scrum to deliver features, but there's no connection there between what they've developed to do their business strategy and what they've developed, you know, from a product delivery framework or product delivery process. And that was, I think, one of the things in the book that stood out the most to me is the connection, the connection between those two things and how important that is. And, you know, I think we can say that there's a tendency for more organizations to focus on the delivery side over the strategy side. But your book goes into a lot of detail on why it's so important that those two things connect. Melissa, you have in there, you know, one of the lines I loved the most in there around this, you know, this component is that you say that strategy should be a decision-making framework. Can you talk a little bit about that concept?
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of misconceptions out there. And I talk a lot about this in the book about what is strategy. And a lot of people like to think that strategy is just a plan, right? Like it's laying out, we're going to do this tomorrow, and the next day we're going to do that. But they don't really look at it as a framework. And good strategy really should be set up to do that. So I think Stephen Bungay talks about strategy the best that I've ever seen it. And I talk a lot about The Art of Action in my book. Because the way that he describes it is that strategy is a way to enable decision making. And if you think about it, that's what leaders need to do in an agile environment. So in Agile, we talk a lot about, you know, pushing decision-making down into the teams and allowing them to be autonomous. And in order to do that, you need to have a strategic framework, a way for those teams to make decisions so that they can operate independently and not go ask for permission every single day. And that's the only way you get out of a command and control environment as well, is to have your leaders responsible for the framework, right, for these teams to make decisions, but then allowing the teams to make those decisions within the framework. So that's what I talk about with deploying strategy up and down into a strategic framework. So it's about aligning, right, the company goals back into those product initiatives and then giving space enough in those intents and in those ways of working for the teams to decide, like, okay, for the next, you know, couple months or for the next couple weeks, this is what we're going to be working on to deliver value to reach those goals. So when we do strategic frameworks, one of the things too that we look for is we don't create too many levels of this. And this is one big issue I see in a lot of enterprise companies. They try to create too many levels of strategy. And what happens is they get down to like the VP level or the director level. And by the time they got there, they're like, go build this button on the screen that says start, because they started so granular at the top. And then they put so many different requirements and OKRs all the way down through the company that they gave no room for people to actually explore. So instead we think about it as really like strategic intents for the business or the business line. So that could be, for example, like moving up market into the enterprise customers, or it could be about reaching revenue goals, or it could be about expanding your product into different geographies, right? Anything that's really going to move your business into different ways. And then we go into product initiatives, which are the second level, about what can we do to our product? What problems can we solve for our customers that are going to help us get into those strategic intents that will help us realize it? And then the teams go figure out the options. What solutions do we build? What features do we produce? How do we get the right workflows down to actually reach those product initiatives? So if we do it that way, the teams are left with enough room to go out and talk to customers, to validate ideas, but they've been given enough of a direction that they're not spiraling all out of control, exploring this really, really big problem space. We've just confined them enough so that they can explore within that comfortably and surface up solutions that go in the same direction the company wants to go in.
Yeah, that's the whole frame the box. I don't know if you've read is that Switch, the Heath Brothers? Mm-hmm. Where they talk about framing the box, but giving people enough structure, right, so that they have space to play inside of that, but there's still opportunity to explore and innovate. Cool. And I think, like you talk about, what you just said is so important from an engineering perspective in building building teams that are engaged and excited about what they're developing and you know, delivering to customers. If they don't have mm-hmm. that space to play, they get bored quickly and they'll leave, right?
Yep. Yeah, like nobody wants to be told what to do every day, right? We hire, and that's another thing too, right? We're all knowledge workers in the software environment, and you know, we're hired because we're smart and we make really good decisions and we want to use our knowledge and we want to explore problems and we want to do really good work. But in command and control environments or places where they pass down solutions to people, you don't give them the opportunity to do that. And that's when you lose great people, I think.
Well, not just be part of the initial building process, but also be part of the feedback process. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that I see teams struggle with often is because they've taken the orders of leaders, and then they see something like a demo or a review as just something to do for acceptance, as opposed to feedback and two-way feedback, because they're missing out on a huge opportunity. To your point about knowledge workers, the person that's sitting in the back of the room that never gets asked any question, they probably got a great idea in their head of a way to improve the product. They're just never asked.
Yep, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's see. I want to make sure that we circle back here and talk about some of the other work that you're doing in the product management space. Can you share with our listeners a little bit about the Product Management Institute and Products Labs?
Yeah. So so Products Labs is a full-stop consultancy to help people set up and scale great product management organizations. So we service two types of customers. We have a partnership with Insight Venture Partners to work with growth stage companies, and we work with other growth stage companies outside of them as well. But we're working with them because Insight really understands that product is a great way to grow companies, and it's really essential for growth stage companies to get that right so that they can scale into software companies that don't have to go through a transformation, right? They're already set up really well to succeed with product. So we come into their companies soon after investment, and we help them hire the right product people. We help them with product strategy. And our team goes in and really helps anybody kind of fill those leadership gaps if there's not really strong product leads, and then we try to hire them in. At the same time with Insight Ventures too, what we're doing with that group of people who work at Products Labs is we are starting a CPO accelerator. So one of the biggest things that I saw having worked on a lot of transformations in these companies is that there wasn't really strong product leadership out there. Like, product is this kind of nascent role that people don't quite understand, and there's no clear path to figure out how do I get from a product manager on a Scrum team to a chief product officer. So we're taking a very smart VPs of product, very successful people, helping to accelerate their careers by training them to be great chief product officers of growth stage companies. And then they will go work at one of the Insight companies in about 2 years after they've gotten experience helping many different companies and seeing lots of patterns along the way. So we're a little accelerator incubator for chief product officers. And I'm really, really excited about that. We kicked off this partnership last year. We have our first CPO in training working with us, and we're actively trying to hire our next one. And we go in and we fill in the gaps, and we help all these companies really grow. On the other side of Products Labs too, we still help a lot of enterprises go through transformations. And what I'm excited about is seeing them really recognize that it's not just an agile transformation, it's also getting their product organization set up correctly to scale. So in those organizations, we come in, we train a lot of people who are first-time product managers. We help them hire in some product leaders around the organizations, design their product organizations correctly from a structure and a strategy standpoint, and make sure they're well set up to keep pursuing that. So we go in and we really assess it, and we help them scale product organizations in that way. And I'm seeing a lot more enterprises really approach it from that perspective of let's stand up a real product org around these things. So that's been very exciting as well. We also have Product Institute, which is an online school for product managers. It's a 10-week course. We're going to be doing a lot of work this year to expand that and to go further into creating more skills for different levels of product managers as well, which I'm very excited about, from new time product managers all the way up to chief product officers. So there's going to be a lot of revamping of Product Institute this year to come, which will be great. And right now it's got our core course on it for anybody who's maybe 1 to 2 years as a product manager and looking to expand their skills and really understand and have a framework around how do we do our job. So that's at productinstitute.com right now.
Very cool. So I'm curious, since for those that, and why wouldn't they, for those that listened to the last podcast where you and Matt talked about your unique take on road mapping, what have you all learned learned from teaching clients recently about that? How have you learned and iterated upon kind of the principles that you teach clients about road mapping?
Yeah, I still think like a lot of the stuff that we talked about really applies when you look at the flow-based road mapping. I have learned a lot about the context of where companies are and where teams are too, that I think you have to recognize. We had a really great talk at our meetup about this too with Giff Constable, who was the VP of product at Axial, about where do you as a product leader really need to lead and where do you need to like step back. And I think that a lot of this goes back into road mapping. And some of the companies that we go into, especially growth stage companies, they don't have a direction that they're going into. Sometimes, it's not all the time, but like sometimes we go in and there's a lack of leadership there. So people are not actually pointed in one direction. They're just kind of like flailing and trying to figure out what to do. And in those cases, we have to come in and my team is responsible for figuring out how do we create a roadmap with imperfect information, but something that's better than everybody's doing right now, and create a 3 to 6 month roadmap, usually related around problems, and get enough information that we can do in a very short amount of time to go in and actually validate that. So sometimes when you come in and it's really messy, you kind of have to be, as a product leader, a little bit more prescriptive about which direction are we going in so that people start going. And then we go back into a flow-based cadence, right? We try to set up those cadences to go in and say, okay, now we can go back and say, like, let's do, you know, our if we're going to kick off our hypothesis testing, right? Like, how do we go do good user research? How do we move our initiatives into testing phases? And how do we make sure that they're getting ready to come out there and then go on? In other cases where you're set up and people are swimming pretty well and you have a good strategic framework around you, the flow-based road mapping that we talk about works very well in those types of organizations, because it allows you to really say, I like it because it allows you to see like what stage things are in. So when it's just a concept and you might kill it, right? And it's in that first column that we were really talking about, where you're just kind of looking at ideation. That means we're still gathering information to make sure that it's a good way to go. And you have to, like everybody has to really acknowledge that in the organization and see that it's not quite right, right? Like we're not really sure that this is going to be out. So it's a good way of communicating like what stage things are in. And then as you become more certain, it keeps going down the roadmap and then gets released. So I think like what I've learned is just more about, I think, the timing of how things go through that stages. Sometimes you have to like accelerate that timing and move things very quickly from ideation all the way through to validation as fast as possible when you're trying to point people in the right direction. And then other times that flow-based roadmap really takes on a cadence of weeks or months or, you know, especially in larger enterprises where you're validating these things over time and really taking it out there.
One of the pieces that's interesting about the way that you even talk about, you know, from our flow-based roadmap podcast to this book mm-hmm. and to this conversation, even just shifting the language into being options rather than deliverables is an important shift for an organization to make down that path that you're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Of here's all the things that we're considering and the options that we're vetting, and we may kill 75% of these. That piece to me seems like even a big cultural hurdle for a lot of organizations to get yes. get to. And it's such a simple shift, right? Of it's not a plan and it's not a list of deliverables. It's just things that we're considering.
Yeah. I think that's one of the biggest like mindset hurdles I've seen for organizations to really adopt more of a product mindset. It's not about, you should not be trying to build everything. If you build everything, you will ruin your product. You'll ruin your business, like guaranteed. Seen it happen a million times. So you really should be striving to do less, right? Like, and you should be considering things as options because you don't want to do them all. Like that will kill your business. That's too costly. It will complicate your product. And a lot of companies have a ton of stuff they could be doing, but focus, I think focus is the absolute key thing that companies need to learn, and that will separate the successful ones from the unsuccessful ones. Like less is more when it comes to focus. And if you can organize and drive an organization around hitting specific objectives and specific goals from a business standpoint down through the product, right? You'll see it produce more. Like, we talk a lot about like shipping, and shipping is a huge part of it. Like, you have to get things out the door, but you're not going to see momentum if you're shipping tiny little things that never add up and into anything. And I think that's really the point and the message that I want to get across for why product strategy and why, you know, moving towards this kind of product organization that I talk about is so important, because it helps make sure that everything you're doing across the organization is all rolling up into the most important things you can do.
Well, Melissa, where can people find you? Do you have any speaking engagements? You said you'd be bowling. Is that at the Brooklyn Bowl?
Yeah, I'm bowling at the Gutter in Brooklyn. Actually, in Long Island City. So if anybody's there, say hi. But I will be at UX Thailand next month, which I'm pretty excited about. I'll be on the industry conference in Dublin in April. And then I will be at Agile 2019, speaking on two tracks, which will get announced pretty soon. But yeah, I hope to find people there. You can check us out at productslabs.com if you're looking to learn more about the business and what we do. And then you can follow me on Twitter at Lissy Jean is my handle, LissiJean. And then I hope everybody goes and reads Escaping the Build Trap. You can get it on Amazon. There are no plans for an audiobook yet. I know people keep asking for it. I'm pushing, but it's not my decision. But you can get it on Kindle or paperback there. And I hope you'll leave me a review after you get a chance to read it.
Yeah, everybody go get a copy. I think I posted on Twitter this morning. I had offered my copy to somebody who is new to a director of product role. I was excited to pass it along to her and was like, you're going to have to go buy your own. I'm keeping this. I need this for myself. Everybody needs their own copy.
I did find that tweet humorous. You were basically like, hands off.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm keeping it. I need it. You did a great job on the book, Melissa, and I can't recommend it enough to people out there, you know, not just in a product capacity. I think it's really important for folks on the engineering side to get familiar with this concept so that they're asking great questions of the product side of the house and holding them accountable to coming with the connection back to the business strategy. So thanks again to you, Melissa, and to our listening audience. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a review, a rating, or leave comments on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcasting platform of choice. It really helps others find us. If this is your first time tuning in, definitely consider subscribing so you don't miss any of our great content. And if you'd like to join the discussion with Melissa from our conversation today, we will be continuing this conversation a week from our publishing date, where you have the opportunity to ask Melissa questions as part of our Agile Ask Me Anything series. And she will respond to those on coalition.agileuprising.com. So if you don't have a account on the Coalition, get one created and head on over to the Ask Me Anything section, where we will have a page dedicated to this conversation with Melissa, and you can ask questions that she will be able to respond to. Until next time, this is the Agile Uprising podcast signing out, and thank you guys again.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.